I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. In the years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, millions have signed up for coverage, leaving about 9% of the population without health insurance. And that's quite an accomplishment. The bill had a rocky start with serious glitches on the website and has had its share of critics. The House of Representatives has tried numerous times to repeal it. And Senator Bernie Sanders wants to replace it with a single-payer system run by the federal government. Meanwhile, United Healthcare Group, and that's the country's biggest health insurer, said it was withdrawing from most of the states where it had been offering plans on the exchange. And it looks like premiums are going up. So in this hour of Radio Times, the health and future of the Affordable Care Act. Joining us from New York is Margot Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the New York Times Upshot section. And Margot, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much. It's good to be here. I'm actually here from D.C.
Oh, D.C. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
Well, here in our Philadelphia studio, and I know that because he's sitting across from me, is Robert Towne, and he's the Gilbert and Shelley Harrison Professor of Healthcare Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And Robert Towne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. Margot, let me begin with you. And I was noodling around on the internet to try to figure out, now, how many people have actually signed up for the Affordable Care Act? And I kept seeing 13 million, then I saw 16 million, I saw as many as 20 million. Do we know?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to think about this. So the Affordable Care Act is not just one thing. It's like a whole suite of different public policies that were designed to give people new ways to get health insurance and also to encourage people who had options before but hadn't signed up to sign up. So, you know, if you think about the Affordable Care Act as this kind of overall umbrella, that's where you get some of the bigger numbers, you know, between people who, you know, their kid, young adults under 26 who got insurance from their parents, or people who signed up for the Medicaid program, or people who signed up in the new Obamacare markets. You kind of add all of those together, you get a really big number. If you're looking just at people who signed up in these new marketplaces, who essentially bought new personal insurance that wasn't available before, then you get numbers kind of more in the 10 to 13 million range.
I'm curious, Robert, just how much churn there is in the system. And by that, I mean people that maybe signed up for one plan under the exchange and then decided they wanted another one.
Well, there's quite a bit of churn both across plans and within the exchange, going in and out of the exchanges as people's incomes changes and their employment status changes. So roughly looking at California data, which I have done, roughly 50%, one-third to 50% of the people are going in and out of the exchange each year.
Is that a lot? I mean, comparing that to, let's say, the kind of insurance that people might get through their employer, does that seem like a lot of churn within the system?
It is a lot of churn, but it's not surprising because these are folks that are not getting insurance to their employer, and so they're going to be kind of more naturally kind of changing their status, their employment status, and there's going to be a lot more fluidity in their situations.
And they're just sort of looking around the exchanges, and as you say, people's status changes, they move to different parts of the country, all of that is a factor?
And they get new jobs. They get a job with a large employer who offers them health insurance, and then they no longer qualify for insurance on the exchange.
Margot, let me go back to you.
Go ahead. Oh, in the individual market before Obamacare, there was a lot of this churn, too, because generally, you know, most people get insurance either from a government program, from Medicare or Medicaid, or from their job. And so the kind of people that didn't have insurance from one of those systems are people who are like a little bit on the margins. They're someone who just lost their job and didn't get a new one, or they're people who, you know, can't really afford what their employer is offering. And there are some people in that category who are self-employed, run their own business, and just didn't have good options before. But there was always a lot of people that were kind of moving in and out of that market as they were sort of transitioning between these other programs. So it's not totally surprising that that continues to be the case. But I think the hope was is that this would create a more stable landing place for people so they might choose, oh, I'm going to start my own business and I know I'm going to be able to get health insurance every year. And so I'm going to stay in this market for longer. And I think that hasn't totally borne out yet, but it's sort of still to be determined.
Margot, we're going to call you back. Your phone is clicking in and out. We want to make sure we get a good phone line with you. So hang up. We'll call you back and we'll get you back on the air. Do you want to talk about the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act, Robert Towne?
Sure. So the affordable part is that hopefully insurers will be competing aggressively for consumers on these exchanges and charging premiums that are kind of close to cost. And then layered on top of that is a subsidy arrangement that the government will cover the cost of the premiums for a good chunk of folks. as well as covering the out-of-pocket costs for even a smaller chunk of folks. So that's the affordable part. So it's the kind of combination of inducing competition with the subsidies that kind of that makes the plans affordable. And for those folks who qualify for subsidies, the plans are quite affordable.
But for people, let's say, who don't qualify, the more, what, middle-class consumer, how are they affected by the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, they're going to be affected less because they're not getting the subsidy, and health care in the United States is quite expensive, so they're going to have to pay for that out of pocket. But what they do get is access to kind of a transparent marketplace so they can compare and shop for plans. And that's something that's new in the Affordable Care Act.
Margo, hopefully we have you back on a better line.
I hope so, too.
I do, too. No, we always like to make sure we can hear our guests loud and clear. One of the articles that I read that you wrote was that something like 80% of healthcare dollars in this country goes to pay for health care. Can you flesh that out? Because I think for a lot of consumers, a lot of people, they feel like they're paying out of pocket. And it seems to be getting more expensive, and they figure, you know, someone is rolling in dough or making a lot of money on our healthcare system.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why it's hard to change the fact that our healthcare system is so expensive. You know, there's been a lot of focus on insurance companies as being this entity that, like, if we could take them out and, you know, give them less profit, then suddenly healthcare would be so much cheaper. And I think that that is not really true. The reality is that most of the dollars that we're spending in the healthcare system are going to pay for doctors and for hospitals and for drugs and for medical devices and all of the other services that we really consider to be medicine and healthcare. And so, you know, there's lots of ways that you can kind of squeeze some dollars out of that. You could use less services that you don't need. Maybe you would pay a little bit less for certain things. But the kind of fantasy that I think a lot of people have that the sort of insurance industry is like the real source of waste, I think, is a little bit overblown.
We were talking about this off the air, but I'll put it to you, Robert Towne, on the air, which is comparing just the cost of our healthcare system in this country to Canada, to the north, or to England or France or some of the sort of equivalent countries. And it seems that we pay a lot less personally and also as part of GDP for our healthcare.
Yeah, we pay a lot more.
I mean, a lot more, yes.
Yeah.
They pay less, we pay more.
Yeah, and the reason for that is that most of these countries have single-payer systems or systems where they can heavily regulate the prices that are paid for services to providers like hospitals and physicians. Because of this market power that these countries have in negotiating with these providers, they're able to negotiate lower prices for physician services and hospital services. So that's what's driving most of the difference between, say, Canada and the U.S. is that doctors are wealthier in the U.S. and than they are in Canada, and that's got to be passed through to consumers in some way.
Are they a lot wealthier in this country, or is it, you know, 10%, 20%, 50%?
I think it's somewhere between, you know, 20 and 30% more.
You agree with that, Margo?
I think that's right. And, you know, if you compare to some European countries, the differential is even bigger.
So, but what's interesting, too, is when you look at, for instance, drug costs. And I know, I believe it's the VA, Margo, that can negotiate with drug companies to get lower costs for things like pharmaceuticals, for drugs. Is that not something that can be applied across the board to reduce some of the costs in this country?
So that's the way, you know, as Robert was saying, that's the way that a lot of countries do things. They have a government entity that does all the purchasing for everyone in the country, and so they can go to all the drug manufacturers and say, you know, this is what we're willing to pay for your product, and if you're not willing to take that price, like, we'll just buy someone else's product. And so that gives them enormous negotiating leverage to lower the price of drugs. The problem we have in the United States is we don't have just one purchaser of drugs. We have lots of purchasers of drugs. We have all, you know, different insurance companies, both government and private insurance companies. And I think we also have kind of culturally a desire to say no to fewer drugs. We want to be able to cover every latest and greatest new treatment. And so the combination of those things means that there's just not as much negotiating power. And so in general, the drug companies have more ability to say, no, you're going to have to pay a higher price than that price that you've offered.
Do you agree with that, Robert, that it's sort of almost like a cultural difference that we want certain things from our healthcare system and they tend to cost more?
Oh, that's absolutely true. The issue here is that if you want to have bargaining leverage, you have to be willing to walk away and you have to be able to live with less options. And that's something that I think Americans are kind of are difficulty with.
just because we're Americans and we want multiple choice?
Well, you know, we're market oriented, and markets generate, you know, a lot of options. And once you go to a single payer system, that's going to almost by necessity require kind of clamping down on options in order to get the leverage, say, with lower drug prices.
Mm. Margo, let me go back.
Yeah,
go ahead.
VA system, so the VA system, as you said, they actually have a purchasing system that's more like a single payer, where they say no to a lot more drugs than other programs in the United States do, and they are able to get much lower prices. But what we see is that a lot of people who get their benefits through the VA and are also eligible for Medicare's drug benefit will sign up for Medicare's drug benefit because they don't want to have to avoid all the drugs that the VA won't buy.
Margaret, let me go back to you. I'm looking at an article that you wrote just a couple of weeks ago. A single-payer plan from Bernie Sanders would probably still be expensive. You have looked at his plan, and he's offering something, an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. First of all, what is he offering, and how would it work, and why is it so expensive?
So he's offering something along the lines of what these other countries have, where the United States government would essentially purchase all health care for everyone in the United States. So instead of having an employer plan or a Medicare plan or a Medicaid plan, there would just be this one system, and everyone would pay tax dollars into the system, and in exchange they would get access to doctors and hospitals and other kinds of medical care. And so I think there are a lot of things about that idea that are appealing. It could potentially allow the United States single payer to be a better negotiator in the way that these other countries are, and maybe, you know, constrain some of the cost of health care. It also would be a system where absolutely everyone in this country would have access to health care. You wouldn't have people who are still uninsured or people who are lower income having more difficulty. The system, as Bernie Sanders describes it, also would eliminate any kind of cost sharing. So you would never have to pay a copayment when you went to the doctor or when you got a drug. Everything would just be covered. So, you know, the things that are good about that is that it's, like, really fair and equitable, and that there may be some ability for the government to negotiate a little bit better than our current fragmented system. The difficulty of it is that, first of all, we know from a lot of research about how people use healthcare that if you take away all of that kind of cost-sharing stuff, if people never have to pay a dollar when they use healthcare, that they're probably going to use more of it, and so that's going to cost more money. And then the other problem is that it's, you know, we can't go back in time to when these other countries established their single-payer system. So we would be building a single-payer system on top of the existing United States healthcare system, which is, you know, the most expensive in the world. And so I think a lot of the supporters of the Bernie Sanders plan hope that if we just had the same kind of system as these other countries, we could just sort of have the low-cost, high-quality systems that we see elsewhere in the world. And what I wanted to point out is that we actually sort of start at this high cost base. And if we want to really get to a cheaper system, then what we have to do is, like, really make cutbacks in what we pay doctors and hospitals. So that's, you know, those are some tough choices.
Sure. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Getting an update on the Affordable Care Act, passed 6 years ago and implemented in the last couple of years. That's Margo Sanger-Katz, also with us, Robert Town. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, we're getting an update on the Affordable Care Act, talking about its future, also talking about what is available under the act, who has signed up, who hasn't. And again, Robert Town is the Gilbert and Shelley Harrison Professor of Healthcare Management at the Wharton School. Margo Sanger-Katz is healthcare correspondent for the New York Times Upshot section. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Robert, anything you want to add to what Margo was saying about what Bernie Sanders is offering? And I should add that Hillary Clinton is offering a version of that, kind of an expansion of Medicare.
No, I think Margo summarized it quite well. I think the issues with healthcare costs, you know, costs are prices times quantities. And so if you're going to affect costs, you've got to affect one or both of those things. Under the Bernie Sanders plans, quantity is going to go up. So costs are going to go up unless prices go down. Now, if you're going to drive prices down to providers, they're going to be quite unhappy and actually probably less likely to offer services. So it actually is kind of a rather complicated problem to solve. To get the, you know, the equation is simple, but how you get there is quite difficult. And a simple plan like Bernie Sanders is probably not going to do it.
And speaking of the word complicated, when you take what we had before the Affordable Care Act and now you add the Affordable Care Act to that, has that brought any clarity or less complication to the system, Robin?
I don't think it's kind of left the system kind of equally complicated, but expanded both the private side, the private health insurance side, as well as the Medicaid side. And so our system is kind of as complicated as it was before and probably will remain that way for some time, just because healthcare is innately complicated and difficult to manage as a society. And it will, in order to get it correct, it's going to be it's very difficult to do, but it's going to require a lot of complication. Even in single-payer countries, you know, they have a lot of layers of regulation and bureaucracy in order to kind of keep caps on things.
Margaret, let me go back to you. And I remember when the Affordable Care Act became the law, some were saying, you know, that companies are going to stop offering health insurance to their workers. They're going to drop that coverage. And people will be, in a sense, kind of forced into the exchanges. Has that happened? Did that happen?
So I think this is actually one of the big surprises for me and how things have worked out. You know, it was always controversial, like how many employers were going to consider dropping coverage and letting their employees go into these new marketplaces. But everyone sort of agreed that some would. And essentially what we've seen over the first few years of this law is almost none have, that most employers are continuing to offer coverage to their workers. And the people who are going into these new marketplaces are really the people we talked about before, who are sort of between things, who are self-employed, who are in transition. So that's sort of a good thing and a bad thing. The good part of that is it means that the law has been a lot less disruptive. You know, people haven't had to lose their coverage and learned how to navigate this new system. I think the bad part of that is it means that these new marketplaces that the law set up have many fewer people in them. And that has turned out to make them a little bit of a less attractive market for health insurers because they just, you know, why start this new line of business if there aren't very many customers there? And so I think that is causing some dysfunction in these new markets that wasn't anticipated.
You want to answer that, Robert?
Yeah, no, I think that is one of the surprises that employers have kind of more or less kept coverage. And it has reduced the scale of the marketplaces, which I think in the long run could be a problem.
Why? You don't have enough people or enough healthy people?
You don't have enough people in general, in particular in these, you know, rural states where you don't have, you know, a ton of people in general. Then you're putting, you know, a fraction of those on the exchange. You know, there's just not enough scale to kind of make it work. And I think that's the concern that insurers have.
We could do a whole show about this, but I'm curious why employers have stuck with the system. I mean, why they decided to, the ones that do, why they decided to continue to cover their employees' health insurance, or at least part of it.
It's because the employees wanted it, right? If you cut your insurance and you say, geez, go to the exchange, you know, the employees are not going to be happy and may look for employment otherwise. You know, it's hard to keep talent, and employers are mindful of that.
Can you talk, Margaret, and then I do want to get some callers in on the conversation about United Healthcare Group. It has described as the country's largest insurer, getting out of most of the states where it has been doing business, offering these plans on the exchange. Why are they doing that, and what does that mean?
So this has been a big headline that the United Health Group, which is the largest health insurer in the country, has exited a lot of these new state exchange markets. But I think it's important to have a little perspective, which is that United Health Group is not the largest insurer on the exchanges. Most of their business is in the employer market and in Medicare. Huh. So they really were sort of late entrants into this market. They got in after a year. In a lot of these states, they didn't end up having a lot of customers. And then what they found is that they had made a pricing mistake. And so it ended up costing them more to take care of their customers than they were collecting in premiums. And they think they just decided as a company, you know, this new market, we can't get enough customers. We can't make enough money on the customers that we're getting. We're just going to pull out and go back to the businesses that we understand better. So in some ways, it's a bad sign because, it's, you know, they're a big, sophisticated insurance company. And if they couldn't make money in these new markets, maybe that's a sign that these markets are really hard to make money in. On the other hand, they're just one insurer and they weren't a big part of this market. So for most customers, the fact that they're exiting doesn't really matter that much. And in most markets, there still is a fair number of choices. There really are only a few places in the country where we're really down to just, you know, one or two choices where you sort of worry about whether there will be enough competition to make the offerings good for customers.
I saw an article where you were quoted, Robert, where you called this creative destruction.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the Affordable Care Act, at least with the marketplaces, is to create a market. And markets are going to have entrants and exits. And as firms figure out, and the insurers who do figure it out well are rewarded, and those who can't figure it out leave. And so I don't think we should be surprised that there's some entry and exit in these marketplaces. And it's not a sign that it's not working. It's just it's what you should expect.
Do we know enough, or has the system been up long enough to know what it takes for an insurance company to make money, to be profitable, to stay viable under the Affordable Care Act, Robert?
I think the insurers are still trying to figure that out. There's been some changes in regulation that were anticipated. You know, the government had some risk corridors, which gave the insurance companies money if they were losing money, and some reinsurance programs so that we'd cover some of their high-risk enrollees. But those programs are being phased out, and as those programs get phased out, insurers have to adjust, and they're trying to understand this market. I think it's a complicated and new market for them. They weren't quite sure who the enrollees were going to be. You know, were they going to be more like a Medicaid enrollee? Were they going to be more like an employer-sponsored, you know, typical enrollee?
Right.
And so that required some learning on the insurance part, and they're still figuring it out, but they're, I think, getting there.
What do you think, Margo? And then we will get some folks to join the conversation.
So there are a few insurers that have done pretty well in this market, and they tend to be ones that take care of a lot of Medicaid patients. So it seems like the insurance companies that have the most experience with kind of a lower income population seem to be doing better. But it also seems like probably the insurance companies that are able to pay the lowest prices to doctors and hospitals are the ones that are doing the best, because they can offer a cheap plan and still keep some money for themselves. So we're seeing more and more insurers actually trying to limit the number of doctors and hospitals that are available as part of their insurance plan, because then they can drive a harder bargain and get a good deal on what they pay those doctors and hospitals, and that's a way that they can make money.
And that's Margo Sanger-Katz. She's healthcare correspondent for the New York Times Upshot section. Robert Towne with us as well, professor of healthcare management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're getting an update on the Affordable Care Act, much to talk about, a complicated system set up a couple of years ago. Let me read a couple of comments here, an email. The Affordable Care Act provides insurance, not care. It added zero doctors, facilities, schools, nor did it cover malpractice, basic failure. I mean, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the Affordable Care Act is, Robert. I mean, it's about insurance. It isn't about necessarily providing care.
No, that's right. But insurance is an important vehicle for which we get access to care. But what the Affordable Care Act does, in large part, is expand health insurance.
Well, I wonder too, Margo, whether people even know. And I'm thinking of the times I've gone to the doctors for, and I have gotten preventive care that's covered under the Affordable Care Act. I don't get charged for it, but I'm also not told that this is due because of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I think part of the complexity of the system is that while we use it, we don't understand exactly how it works.
Yeah, I think there's sort of two problems with understanding the Affordable Care Act. One is that it was just an enormous piece of legislation. You know, it created these new insurance markets and, you know, gave a lot of people insurance that couldn't get it before, but did tons of other things too. And it's just hard to get your arms around and even describe that in just a few sentences to you on the radio. But, you know, it created calorie counts on, you know, menus at restaurants. It changed all of these insurance regulations. It required that your flu shot and your mammogram be offered to you without you having to pay anything out of your pocket. It provided money for communities that want to, you know, add sidewalks and parks and help people live healthier lives. There's so many things in this law. So I think, in general, people just don't understand all of the things, and so they kind of tend to focus on the thing that gets the most attention, which is these new insurance markets.
Let me get some callers in. We've got Dan from Collingswood, New Jersey, joining us. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Your guest had commented on some of the differences between our free market system and some of the other ones over in Europe, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a comment that I'd like to hear your guest's response about. So we have the ideal of a free market in this country. However, when you're in an ambulance, there really isn't a choice over which hospital you go to or even which ambulance company you're using. And when you get to the hospital, there's no real visibility to the price of your care because your different insurers have struck deals with the hospitals that you don't really get to know until after the time of service. So despite our ideal of a free market, it's kind of skewed by so many different factors. And I'll take my response.
Sure. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Robert, you want to take that? I mean, it is true certainly under emergency circumstances, you probably don't know what your care costs until after the fact.
Yeah. So that's, one of the challenges in the healthcare system is that to induce competition, right, that's what we'd like to have. But that's challenging for a number of reasons. And price transparency is one of those reasons. But what we do is we have insurance companies hopefully competing with each other, and I sign up for them. And then they'll negotiate and take care of all that stuff that, you normally think about when you go to the grocery store and shop for stuff. Mm-hmm. The insurance company is doing that shopping for you, and they're negotiating the prices for you. And so that's kind of one of the important roles of an insurer, is that they're kind of a smart shopper for us, because you wouldn't want to go to the doctor and try to negotiate how much my physical should be. You want the insurance company to do that. So that's kind of how we have it set up, and that's kind of the vehicle by which competition takes place here.
Whether we like it or not, or know it or not, or understand the transparency of it or not.
Or the imperfectness of it.
Or the imperfectness of it, exactly. Let me go back to you, Margot. And I'm curious about e-records. That's also part of the Affordable Care Act, right?
So that actually was part of a law that was passed as part of the stimulus package, so a little bit before the Affordable Care Act. But there was a big federal law that said, we really need more doctors using computer records and not paper, and we're going to create some standards for the products that are in this market, and we're going to provide some funding to help doctors and hospitals buy them. So there's been, over these last few years, a real growth in the use of these systems, but it's still not universal, and there still are lots of problems and bugs. It's not, I think, that the sort of fantasy of having this like universal, simple, easy to communicate kind of system, like we just haven't realized that yet. But it is better than it was 10 years ago, where everyone was writing things down with a pen and paper.
Although I hear doctors complaining bitterly about e-records, or just the transition, the cost of going to e-records and the complexity of going and literally just sort of manually putting all that information into a computer. I'm looking at you, Robert.
Yeah, these systems are enormously expensive, and their efficacy is uncertain. In part, it's just cumbersome for providers that they spend a lot of time on data entry, and it's easy to make mistakes in these records that stay there forever. And so it's not obvious that they have a lot of value. I've done some work in this area, and early returns suggest that maybe for the very ill, there's some returns to the electronic medical records. But other than that, it's uncertain.
Will it take time to sort of see some improvements, or is there something sort of systemically wrong with it?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead, and then I'll get you in, Margo.
So the challenge is that these systems are very siloed. So a hospital has its system, a physician has its system, a different hospital system has its own system, and they don't talk well to one another. So kind of this vision of having, your information in an easy, accessible place for any provider to look at is generally not true.
But why? I mean, Margo, we don't have typewriters but we don't have keyboards with letters in different places. I mean, there is a kind of uniformity there.
Well, I think there are a lot of special challenges when it comes to health records that you don't face in other sectors. So one is that, there are really high standards of privacy. Nobody wants someone to be able to hack into their medical records or their, doctor to email your health records to their friend or anything like that. So there's a lot of emphasis on keeping these records really secure. And a side effect of that, I think, is that it makes it harder for them to share. The other problem is that the companies that make these records, they're competing with each other, and they really want every hospital and doctor to buy their system. And so they don't have a huge incentive to make it easy for the information on one system to be transferred to another one, because that kind of interferes with their competitive advantage. So I think this is a hard problem to solve, and I think it's been frustrating that the shift to electronic records has not led to the kind of conveniences and easy sharing of information that we see in a lot of other places where there's been computerization.
And I've even heard doctors say they feel like it's changing their medical practice. I mean, literally the sort of eye contact that they want to have with their patients when they've got a screen there. And I'm looking again, I'm looking at you, Robert Towns, since you're sitting across from me.
Yeah, yeah. You hear that providers, complain that what they do is they type as they listen into the patient and make sure they kind of record everything. And I think that's one of the big complaints from providers is that now they're just kind of data entry people.
Margot, I know you have to leave us in a minute or two. Just a comment from our Facebook page. The Affordable Care Act is hell if you're working poor. If you earn right at about the threshold for Medicare, you can be bounced back and forth between programs. Some truth to that?
Absolutely, there's truth to that. There's revolving door. You know, the goal is to try to make it seamless when you kind of qualify for one program and then things change and you qualify for a different component of the ACA and try to make that, door kind of smooth. But that's a challenge. It's a bureaucratic challenge. And it's a real challenge, particularly in states that didn't expand Medicaid, because mm-hmm. then there are some people kind of fall through the cracks there.
You want to add to that, Margo?
Yeah, I think that, people who are kind of close to the range of eligibility between Medicaid and these new exchanges can kind of have to bounce back and forth. And I think that can be really disruptive because you've got to get new doctors sometimes. You've got to fill out a lot of paperwork. But I do think that people who are in that income category have a really good opportunity to get insurance. If they're on the Medicaid side, then they get insurance without having to pay anything. And if they're on the exchange side, they get really generous government subsidies that make paying their health insurance premium a very small expense. It's as you get kind of higher up the income scale, actually, that we see the Affordable Care Act being sort of less of a good deal, especially for people that we think of as relatively well off, people who, earn four times the federal poverty level. Those people have to pay the full price of their premiums out of their pocket. And so as we see the premiums kind of get more and more expensive, those are people I hear from a lot who say, gosh, I have to pay all these thousands of dollars to get my premium, and then there's a huge deductible that comes with my plan. Is this really worth it for me? So there's different challenges for people at different stages of the income scale.
Well, Margo, we have to say goodbye to you, and thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's Margo Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the Upshot section of the New York Times. Robert Towns staying with us for the rest of the hour. I could see lots of people want to join our conversation talking about our healthcare system, talking about the Affordable Care Act, 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some more comments after this very short break as well. Stay with us. Much more. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Robert Towne. He's the Gilbert and Shelley Harrison Professor of Healthcare Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, getting an update on the Affordable Care Act and, frankly, how we do health insurance in this country, and it is complicated. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Paul from Center City, Philadelphia. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I was a computer person who automated some rather large nationwide systems, including the stock exchange in the United States and major banks in Canada. I just wanted to mention that when I started a trade on the New York Stock Exchange, averaged $40, it's now $2. So the healthcare system just has to be a little patient, chase the money, and you'll find a solution. But having said that, I lived much of my adult life in Canada and enjoyed the nationwide system that they had there. And if I could make a single suggestion about
Sure.
the cost of medicine, it would be stop the advertising, or alternatively, tell the pharmaceutical companies, go ahead and advertise, which, by the way, most physicians are against, go ahead and advertise, do not transfer that price into the cost of the medications, eat it out of your profit.
Well, Paul, let me take your comment. We have a lot of people that want to join us. Would Robert Towne stopping advertising, and I have to say, depending on what you watch on television, is basically wall-to-wall advertising for pharmaceuticals. Would that in any way impact how much we pay for healthcare?
Probably a little bit, but it's not a big factor. I mean, marketing is a really important thing that drug manufacturers do in order to get people to consume their drugs. There's actually some positive impact of advertising. It's not just kind of annoying on TV. That actually brings people into the doctor's office and has them talk to their doctor about the drug, and that might be kind of the big impact of advertising is that it brings people into the doctor's office to talk about their condition, and they might not even get the drug that was originally advertised. In fact, that's often the case.
Although doctors complain or have said, people come in and they say, I want that drug that I just saw or I saw last night advertised on television.
Yeah, and doctors will also say, and I'll give it to them just to get them out of my office because, right, you know, there's not a lot of downside and it might be good for them. So and United States is one of the few countries that allows advertising. New Zealand's the other one. It's a pretty obvious and clear signal of the market system we have in the U.S. It's a little unclear about kind of what its net consequences are. My sense is it's not large.
Let me get Paul. Thanks for the call. Let's get Elaine from New Jersey to join us. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been watching. You know, I didn't turn on for the whole show, so maybe I missed it. But in your discussion of single payer and the Bernie Sanders plan, and the cost, you know, and your assessment that it would be so expensive, I didn't hear you talking about the reduction in overhead from the insurance companies and the reduction also in profit. I mean, with the elimination of the, what is basically not a value add, I mean, I see the insurance companies as having no added value in terms of health care. They're in between. They cost a lot of money. There's tremendous amount of overhead and negotiating by all these different companies, and as well as the overhead that the practitioners are saddled with because of the office staff.
Sure.
To deal with this.
And Elaine, your question is about administrative costs and how much that affects
and
profit as well. Can you take that?
Yeah, I think one of the big myths that of our healthcare system is that administrative costs that the insurers incur is kind of waste. You know, it actually is doing stuff. And what are they doing? They're doing things like monitoring physician quality. They're negotiating prices. They're making sure that people are getting the necessary care. Now, sometimes they're trying to withdraw, you know, necessary care, but they're actually doing stuff that matters for a more efficient system. They're, in fact, that's kind of one of the ideas behind having insurers compete with each other, is that they're trying to be more efficient in how the care is being delivered. And so it's not going to waste. And so I think, you know, without that administrative expense, you may have a lot more health expenditures as people are getting a lot of care they might not need, and they're paying prices that are a lot higher because there's no one negotiating kind of low prices for them from the providers. So administrative costs are doing something.
But the administrative costs for Medicare are so much lower than they are for private insurance. They're also doing some of those same duties.
Yeah, so that's a great point. Medicare has very little low administrative costs, but also in the Medicare system, you see a consequence of that, and that is that the variation in spending is quite large on a geographic basis, and that's, you know, we're not exactly sure why that's happening, but you know, a lot of it seems to be driven by providers doing different things in different areas. And in private insurance, you don't see the same variation. It kind of comes with different – it comes by different prices based on providers having different leverage. And so, you know, administrative cost is kind of keeping the quantities the same across the country for the private insurers. But Medicare, the quantities are kind of varying quite a bit. People are getting a lot more care and maybe not very good care in a lot of parts of the country.
I began by talking about the fact that there's something like 9% of the population that does not have health insurance. Millions have actually signed up through the Affordable Care Act. Who is that 9%, and are they all going to be, in a sense, forced into the system one way or the other?
Well, about half of that 9% would qualify for health insurance under the ACA in a very reduced cost way. There people would qualify for Medicaid. There people would qualify for premium tax credits on the exchange. So about half of that, you know, 9% are folks like that. And the other half are people who wouldn't qualify for ACA benefits, either because they're in jail or they're here illegally. And so that's roughly how it's breaking down.
I was looking. I do want to get some callers, and I guess see a lot of complaints about the Affordable Care Act. There was a recent study from the Commonwealth Fund finding that, and I was frankly surprised to read this, about 82% of American adults enrolled in private or government coverage through the health care law said they were somewhat or very satisfied. Does that hold up from your perspective?
Yeah, I think the Kaiser Foundation had a similar survey and found, you know, similar results, that people are generally pretty happy with the coverage they got, particularly if they're getting highly subsidized coverage, right? They're getting access to reasonably high-quality health insurance at pretty low prices, and so that's a pretty attractive thing.
Mm. Is that sustainable, the idea? I'm not sure how many millions of people are getting their health insurance subsidized by the U.S. government, but is that sustainable going forward?
So on the exchanges, about 10 million people are getting their coverage and, subsidized, and it is sustainable. In fact, the enrollment in the exchanges are a little lower than anticipated, and so the healthcare law is actually cheaper than it was anticipated to be, mostly because people aren't signing up as much as they thought they would be. And so I think it is sustainable. I think it's kind of, you know, that's the plan. It's actually becoming more sustainable than originally planned.
Interesting. Let me get Carol from Wilmington, Delaware to join our conversation. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. You know, no system or program is turnkey, truly. You're going to have to work at it. And I just want to know, are they continually improving this system? Or is it? It just seems like it's a stagnant system. They turned it on, and you know, everybody's got to make it work. Or is there a process going on where there's continual improvement, making it better and better
sure.
as we go along?
It's a good question, Carol. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah. Well, as if you kind of look back, it was kind of a disaster when it first rolled out. The websites weren't working. It was kind of imploding on itself. And there's been dramatic improvements in the last several years on the websites and how they're operating. And the states who operate their own healthcare marketplaces are making improvements, you know, pretty continuously. Mm-hmm. So there is a, you know, kind of they've been moving through different stages. First, just turn on the lights and make it kind of work. And now they're trying to optimize it and try to make it a more friendly place for consumers to shop and to purchase health insurance. And health insurance is a very complicated product. And so it's a challenge to develop a website that it actually makes, empowers consumers to make, you know, good choices.
The goal was obviously to get more people covered, with the idea that if you have more people have an insurance, they will be healthier in the end. Are we healthier? It's only been a couple of years, but, and I don't know how that shakes out, but are we healthier?
Well, there was an article today in the New York Times, you know, highlighting that we're actually dying at a higher rate than we
than
we have in the past. Now, that's probably unrelated to anything having to do with health insurance, but I think we're it's a little too early to tell. In general, the impacts of health insurance are going to be subtle. In trying to measure it, like for a given individual, it may be quite dramatic that they can get access to it, but that might be one out of 50 people that right. really has these big impacts, and it's hard to kind of measure that across the population. But my guess is that we'll see some you know modest improvements in our health.
Is there less medical debt? Do we know? Has it helped people paying some of their healthcare bills, or perhaps not having to pay them because it's covered?
Yeah, there's been a pretty large impact on the rate of bankruptcy, and people are going to have high medical expenses because they have insurance now. So that is one of the notable benefits of the ACA.
And that's a big benefit. I mean, imagine, you know, as a person worrying about covering these bills or having to declare bankruptcy or something like that.
Yeah, there's 20 million people who are now more or less protected from that type of bankruptcy, and that's a big benefit.
Yeah. Let me get Larry from Overbrook Park to join our conversation. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is probably a subject for the entire show and maybe all our lives. But both your guests spoke very eloquently about insurance. But it's not about insurance. It's about health care. And what is it going to take for this country to understand that everybody that is born deserves to live a full life? That includes health care, not insurance. And there's a lot more I can say about that.
Well, that's enough, Larry. That's good enough. I mean, he's basically saying health care as a right, that we have a right to, I guess, not just health care, but the opportunity for a healthy life.
Yeah, and the challenge is, and I think that's a very common sentiment. The challenge is, what's that right amount, and how much you're going to pay for it? right? And so that's the challenge, and how you determine those things is a very difficult task. And that's one of the things that insurance does, is it actually kind of tries to figure out what's the right price. Mm. And that's something that as an individual can be very difficult. And if you're covered by health and by insurance, you may have no incentive to kind of care about price. And that has negative consequences insofar as people, you know, consume too much health care and have inefficient use of health care. So it's very nice to say, geez, you know, everybody has a right to health care. But the real question is kind of how much health care and at what price.
And how much does our lifestyle, we are more sedentary population, I think, certainly than we used to be generations ago. We have things that do things for us. That has led to some of these chronic diseases we have to deal with, the problems of obesity in this country. How much is that just a cost driver?
Health style matters. Obesity maybe kind of matters less than I think a lot of people think.
Really?
If you're, you know, modestly obese and to just a little bit obese, probably the impact is pretty modest on your healthcare expense. It's when you get kind of morbidly obese that there's really big impacts. And, you know, while our lifestyle, you know, matters, you know, technological change has also been pretty important. The trend in cardiovascular disease mortality has been declining until this year pretty steadily. And cancer mortality is starting to decline as well. So we're starting to see some impacts. Maybe our lifestyle kind of works against that, but technology has also been driving down the morbid or the consequences of these diseases.
Do we, I've read this, but I just want a reality check. Do we spend more healthcare dollars at the end of someone's life? Is that where, if you look over the span of a life, that's where we're spending the most dollars?
Yeah, we don't spend the most dollars in the last 6 months of life, but a large chunk of expenditures, maybe a third of total expenditures, are in the last 6 months of life. And, you know, you might think, geez, that's kind of a waste because they're going to.
Sometimes you don't know when the end is coming.
But that's the problem. You don't know when the end is. So you don't know when that last 6 months, you know, you're trying to spend this money to prevent the last, that death. And so you just don't know when it, that point is. So it's not easy to eliminate.
How would you change let's keep it sort of simple. How would you change the Affordable Care Act?
If I were able to pass something through Congress, I think, you know, there's some modest things that one can do that I think would be very useful. I think having all states expand Medicaid would probably be a very valuable endeavor. I think, you know, some of the regulations involving the ACA, I think I would probably – I'd get rid of the individual mandate. Yeah, I'd get rid of the employer mandate. I think they just complicate things and they don't really
You don't need them?
I don't think you really need them.
Because people are going to do it anyway?
Yeah. I think that the early evidence is that the individual mandate's having very little impact on people's decisions to sign up for insurance. And the employer mandate is just adding a lot of bureaucracy. And again, I don't think it's really affecting employer behavior. And there are better ways to do it. So those would be kind of a couple things I might do.
We're going to end on that note. Robert Towne, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he is the Gilbert and Shelley Harrison Professor of Healthcare Management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And joining us at the top of the hour, she stayed with us for most of the show, Margot Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the New York Times Upshot section. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, but stay right where you are. We've got hour two coming your way. Stay with us. We'll be right back.